I wanted to take a minute and read something from this book. It's called The One Straw Revolution, An Introduction to Natural Farming. And where's there, Chris? There's hope for crop scientists and soil scientists. There's hope for us. He turned me on to this guy. His name is, I'm going to mangle it. It's a Japanese name, Fukuoka, something like that. And it's a book about farming. That's what it's about. And yet in it, there's a couple of pages that are pretty amazing. And this guy is telling his story of his early years. He was a plant pathologist working in a research lab. This is basically a person who studies plant diseases. And that's what he was doing. He was a young man, and he was living in the city of Yokohama. He's basically talking about how he was a young guy. It was a great city to be a young man in. There was a lot going on, and he was enjoying the nightlife and all those sorts of things. He says, in the evening, either in or out of love, I played around and enjoyed myself. I believe it was this aimless life, coupled with fatigue from overwork, that finally led to fainting spells in the research room. The consequence of all of this was that I contracted acute pneumonia, and he wound up having to go into the hospital. It was winter, and through a broken window, the wind blew swirls of snow around the room. This is in the hospital. this is right after, apparently, this is right after World War II. It was warm beneath the covers, but my face was like ice. The nurse would check my temperature and be gone in an instant. As it was in a private room, people hardly ever looked in. I felt I had been put out in the bitter cold and suddenly plunged into a world of solitude and loneliness. I found myself face to face with the fear of death. So here it begins. As I think about it now, it seems a useless fear, but at the time I took it seriously. When I was finally released from the hospital, I could not pull myself out of my depression. In what had I placed my confidence until then? I had been unconcerned and content, but what was the nature of that complacency? I was in an agony of doubt about the nature of life and death. I could not sleep, could not apply myself to my work. In nightly wanderings above the bluff and beside the harbor, I could find no relief. One night as I wandered, I collapsed in exhaustion on a hill overlooking the harbor. I lay there, neither asleep nor awake until dawn. I can still remember that it was the morning of the 15th of May. In the days I watched the harbor grow light, seeing the sunrise and yet somehow not seeing it. As the breeze blew up from below the bluff, the morning mist suddenly disappeared. Just at that moment, a night heron appeared, gave a sharp cry, and flew away into the distance. I could hear the flapping of its wings. In an instant, all of my doubts and the gloomy mist of my confusion vanished. Everything I had held in firm conviction, everything upon which I had ordinarily relied, was swept away with the wind. I felt that I understood just one thing. Without my thinking about them, words came from my mouth. In this world, there is nothing at all. I could see that all the concepts to which I had been clinging, the very notion of existence itself, were empty fabrications. My spirit became light and clear. I was dancing wildly for joy. I could hear the small birds chirping in the trees and see the distant waves glistening in the rising sun. I felt that this was truly heaven on earth. Everything that had possessed me, all the agonies disappeared. And something one might call true nature stood revealed. I think it could safely be said that from the experience of that morning, my life changed completely. Sort of Japanese humility there coming out there. Despite the change, I remained at root an average foolish man, and there has been no change in this from then to the present time. Seen from the outside, there is no more run-of-the-mill fellow than I. And there has been nothing extraordinary about my daily life. But the assurance that I know this one thing has not changed since that time. I have spent 30 years, 40 years, testing whether or not I've been mistaken, reflecting as I went along, but not once have I found evidence to oppose my conviction. That this realization in itself has great value does not mean that any special value is attached to me. I remain a simple man. I tell the young people up in my orchard again and again not to try to imitate me. And it really angers me if there is someone who does not take this advice to heart. I ask instead that they simply live in nature and apply themselves to their daily work. No, there is nothing special about me, but what I have glimpsed is vastly important.
Wow.
Yeah. And then he goes on to spend the rest of the book basically outlining his system that he thinks will lead a person to find their true nature.
Really?
It's utterly foreign to me how this could possibly work. But that said, the amazing thing to me is again the varieties of religious experience. Someone was talking about that book, and the utter variety of what, you know, the fundamental realization is the same, yet the manifestation of the individuals and how to go about, how they think you can go about finding what they found is so vastly different. It just is just mind-boggling to me. But the main thing from this, from what I just read, and to me the theme that's been on my mind is that we do not understand the depth of our unknowing and our uncertainty about our life. We do not understand that. We are, yes, we question, but we don't look at our experience, for one thing, from moment to moment, and realize how, as I think Art said, tenuous. I don't remember if that you brought that up or not, but how tenuous every moment of our existence is, and that we don't know anything about the most basic facts of life. We have no clue. And if we would just, you know, it goes back to that, those moments of honesty, if we could just grasp that, then so much would become clear about what we want to do and what I forget how you were phrasing it, Art, but what our, you know, our strategy, you know, that strategy, our essential strategy, as I think Ricky was saying, would become much clearer. There are three characteristics which just a fellow sent me a book. David Skolman sent me a book. It's called the Absolute Teachings of the Buddha, something along that line. Never heard it before. Never heard of this guy. Ingram is his name. He's a hardcore Vipassana meditator. He says that the Buddha said that there are three characteristics of existence. I know I've read this before, but it caught me by surprise when I saw how simple it is what he's saying. And those three characteristics are suffering, impermanence, and non-self. That experience will never permanently satisfy us. That's one characteristic of life. Experience will never permanently satisfy us. Number two, all things are impermanent. All of our experience, everything is impermanent. And the third thing is that there is no permanent self. those are the three fundamental facts. Tonight's talk is called The Business of Seeking, about a book called From Good to Great. One of the first things that Jim Collins says in this book, and this is a business book, I want you to understand that, it's about how to build a well-functioning company. The first thing that he says, when you start with an honest and diligent effort to determine the truth of the situation, the right decisions often become self-evident. And, you know, and this, it just amazes me how truth is all around us. All of these messages are saying, you know, this is the truth of your situation. This is how you can find a way out. These people are telling us how to find a way out. You know, Jim Collins is telling us how to begin. The path will be revealed for us. And the Buddha is telling us, you know, here's what the truth of the situation is. And look for yourself. You can see this. If you actually start to look at your moment-to-moment experience, you will see what the Buddha says. Now, it may take some convincing before you, like Mike said, before you, how did you say, know versus understand, or realize versus understand?
Realize versus understanding. Taking the leap from understanding to realizing, do you think acceptance is involved in that? So if I understand it intellectually, maybe I'm not realizing it because I'm not willing to accept it?
I could use that terminology, sure. Sure, that it applies to you. It goes back to what we were saying about Eckhart Tolle. You know, Eckhart Tolle says, your whole life is on the tombstones between this date and this date. Everyone in the audience goes, ha, 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 ha. You know, he's talking about that guy. Nobody's going, holy heck, he's talking about me now, my life. And the Buddha is talking about your existence. Yourself, your happiness. And everybody is saying, just look. Just begin to look inside. Yeah, we can see everyone else's unhappiness and futility and impermanence. But begin to go within, as Rose says, go within. And how do you go within? Well, there's everything from farming, you know, how you use growing rice as a way of going within, to, you know, techniques, you know, effortless meditation, and on and on and on. And all of those, we take those and we find, you know, they're the jumping off point for finding our own way. Because every person will find a unique way of going within. You may grow orange trees rather than rice, you know. let me bring up a couple of things from Collins' book, because there's some very practical advice I think that he gives for people. And basically what he did, what his research team did, is they looked at about 1,100 different companies that they ran. You know, they ran through, all the companies that had ever been in the Fortune 500 or something, and then they ran those through filters. They came up with something like 1,100 companies, and I can't remember how they filtered those down even further. But he says that there's a difference between being good and being great. And well, I say that that's the same thing applies to a person who's seeking. There's a difference between being good and being great and being successful. And that's what we want to know. Well, what's the secret to that? So he wound up with all these many companies. He found 11 that he felt had gone from good to great based on all of these elaborate criteria, which is in the back of the book if you want to get into the analytical side of it. You can read all about that. So he found common denominators for going from good to great. The first of these was confront the brutal facts. Confront the brutal facts. And that goes back, that goes back to being honest. How do we be honest? And what he did was come up with four methods, let's say. And let me, forgot I got a handout. So the visual people can look as I'm talking, pass it around. If we need more, there's more.
More there.
Yeah, I did that. That you're sort of fanning out.
Do you need more
back there? Oh, okay. There, I got some more. So I'm at number four on here. We're confront the brutal facts. The interesting thing about this, and this Lauren and I were talking about this a little bit, yes, it says confront the brutal facts about reality while maintaining faith that you will prevail in the end. There's this paradox here. He calls it the Stockdale paradox. After Admiral Stockdale was held by it was like John McCain. He was held in the Hanoi Hilton for however many years. He said that the people who died, the people who didn't make it, were the optimists. Because they would always say, well, we'll be out by such and such date. And that date would come and they wouldn't be released. And they would have a huge disappointment. And they would say, well, we'll be out 3 months from now. And they would just wither away as their optimism continually was proven wrong. And he says, well, we say that, yes, we are here. That's the fact of it. We have no idea when we're going to get out. But I have faith that I will make it through this. It may not mean that I get released. I have faith in myself. So how do we... number A says, well, how do we create a culture of truthfulness? That's what Collins calls it. And the first thing, I love this, lead with questions, not answers. You know, we're not postulating. We're not saying, oh, well, this is probably the way that it is. No, we're asking questions of ourselves. We're asking questions of the things that we read. Engage in dialogue and debate. And this is, number two is referring, well, in discussions with other people rather than coercing them. And that's, to me, that's true confrontation. That's what confrontation in a group is. It should be that the debate about things, not that you're trying to tell someone that this is the way that it is. Number three, conduct autopsies of mistakes without blame. It's a thing I think that people do not do with themselves. When they set a goal for themselves and they don't make it, they don't go back and figure out why. What is it about me that caused me to fail? Why didn't I start that group I said I was going to start? Why did that peter out? Why did the commitment that I make to lose weight, stop smoking, all those little things, those failures will become magnified in larger failures. The same processes of failure are always going on in ourselves. And we've got to look at that, look at the mistakes that we've made, and figure out, what's going on here? What is our strategy that's causing us to go to these defaults that we go to? We can figure that out, and we may need help from other people to figure that out. And the last thing, the building red flag mechanisms that warn us of impending problems. I think that that's especially where a group comes in. People who are watching out and seeing us getting back into, Collins uses the word, the doom loop of, failure and now more failure and these failures building upon each other. I think that journals are a way of building red flag mechanisms for ourselves. We make the notes to ourselves. My friend Alex Levy, when he went over to Malaysia recently, we sat down before he left and we wrote out, here are the problems that I'm going to have in Malaysia with getting my work done, with trying to be successful in my job. Here's what's going to hold me up. Here are the reasons I'm going to get depressed. Here's what I'm going to do about it. Before he even left, you take that with you. And that's a way of reminding ourselves when we had a moment of clarity, because we won't have that a few days from now. We'll lose that clarity. How do we remember it? So I think that's extremely practical information right there. Number five, this idea of a hedgehog concept and a culture of discipline. Well, the hedgehog concept is, Collins says, basically there's two types of companies. There's foxes and there's hedgehogs. Foxes are sly and cunning and fast and always on the move. The hedgehog is this little creature who moves around very slowly. He's just got one thing on his mind. He's got his little routine and the way that he goes about things. It's a very successful strategy for hedgehogs. So he says that, hey, we just need to be focusing on one thing. What is that one thing that we want? What are we going for? And that's the central concept around which all of our actions radiate. And hopefully, that concept is something like, you laid out. How did you say that this morning?
I desire the truth. We come together in pursuit of truth.
That would be the hedgehog concept. And our life, our energy revolves around that and not of the delusions and the distractions. And that is core to being successful. And this was great advice. It says, create a stop doing list. Here are the things that, these are extraneous. These are things I'm going to work on, stop doing. And I swear, Rose said, it wasn't so much the things that I did, it was the things I didn't do. And here's Colin saying the same thing. And, I just hope that, the weight of the evidence of all these people saying the same thing, She goes, oh yes, this is good. I understand. These are things that I need to do. The flywheel, number six. Hey, we know all about that. Sustained effort and consistent direction will yield results over time. And that man there, he is a human flywheel, Augie. You know, you're not looking for the guru. You're not looking for, this is the retreat that's going to do it. If I just shell out $1,500 and I go out and I see this person, that's going to push me over the edge. That's not how it's going to happen. If I gather all my canned goods and I'm going out for 30 days and I'm not coming out till, you know, that those kind of superhuman efforts are not the thing that lead to success. It's the day-to-day pushing. This he gives the image of a large wheel. We push it a little bit one day, and we push it a little bit the next day, and the next day it goes a little further, and a little further, and a little further, and it's a vector. This is Richard Rose's vector, just in a different language. Number seven, level five leadership. This ties in with the, to me, with the concept of living a life of betweenness. It says, humility and modesty combined with stoic determination and ferocious resolve. Level five leaders see the window and the mirror. Things that go well are attributed to outside factors. We are thankful that things went well. We don't say, look what I did. We are glad that things worked out. When things go poorly, we do that autopsy. Why did it come out this way? You know, what we take some of that responsibility, because next time we want to try to avoid the mistakes that we made.
What's the window in the mirror?
The window in the mirror, the window means that the things that go well, we look outside. We look through the window, outdoors. And the mirror means that we look at the guy in the mirror, well, on the things that didn't go well. Okay, number eight, first who, then what. I interpret this a little bit. It's basically about finding good people to work with. In the business world, he's talking about hiring the right people. Hiring good people, determined people, people who buy into the whatever your hedgehog concept is. But for me, this has to do with the group and surrounding yourself with people who are trying to do the same thing that you are, and using that law of extra proportional returns. I think that's what Rose called that. That, you know, one person alone, when you have two people, you get 2.5 times as much work, not just twice as much work. When you have five people, you get, you know, some. It's not just a one-to-one relationship when you're with a group of people. You magnify each other. You bring each other up if you have good people that you're finding. Like Chris and his local group, you know, he's trying to find good people to work with. And that's part of success. And this last one, the technology accelerators. You know, I phrase that, hey, it's not the books, it's not the latest technique, it's not some method that's going to be the answer. Those things will accelerate your progress, well chosen, but they're not going to be the sole solution, let's say. Now, the last thing on here, again, it amazes me. This comes from Jim Collins. You know, I guess he's a PhD. I'm not sure if he's a PhD or not. Strictly interested, you know, in the business world. I believe it is no harder to build something great than to build something good. The beauty and power of the research findings is that they can radically simplify our lives while increasing our effectiveness. There is great solace in the simple fact of clarity about what is vital and what is not. And Dave and I were talking earlier, and Dave said, "Well, what's, you know, what is it about finding an answer? You know, what is it? What's changed? What's the big deal, basically?" I thought about it a second, and I said, "It's certainty. It's the one thing that we don't have, and it's the one thing that we can find is certainty." And that is the difference between night and day. Even just in this, you know, in this day-to-day life, that's the difference between night and day. Something solid within ourselves versus being like creatures made out of sand. And even, you know, again, I go back to Rose. Collins is saying that even, when I read this, even if we don't find an ultimate answer in our lifetime, we have made a better life for ourselves. That's what he's saying here. And why not? Because it's just as easy to be completely dedicated to a spiritual path as it is to live the alternative of waffling from one thing to the next in uncertainty. You're going to put the time in anyway. Yeah. All right, that's it. I plow right through stuff. You know, it's laid. To me, it's laid out pretty simple right there.